Governor Jay Inslee declared a state of emergency yesterday due to wildfires. That move means the National Guard will be deployed to help battle the fires in central and eastern Washington. What does that look like? Today, two National Guard Black Hawk helicopters arrived in Spokane, and 100 members of the Guard are making their way right now to northeast Washington. But a thing about those 100 people being sent into basically an inferno, they are not daily firefighters. They are bankers and construction workers. Some work at the Fred Meyer. What is it like to work with firefighters with almost no experience? Here to answer that question is Aaron Schmidt, Fire Operations Chief at the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
100 people doing something important, but with training, but not really experience. How does that work?
Well, you know, so we have a tremendous asset in Washington with the Guard men and women, the soldiers, and you know we've recognized that for many years. We put on preseason training. We put them through the wildland firefighter basic firefighter training, which is the same training we put our own folks through. And again, like you mentioned, these folks aren't firefighters by trade, and but they are a part of a big organization. They are professionals, and they come out to our fires with enthusiasm and a willingness to help and participate and protect communities in Washington. And the enthusiasm is always very high with these folks.
You've got a compressed amount of time. What do you focus on when you're trying to train up somebody with little or no experience in fighting fires?
Well, I think the single most important thing with fire, no matter what you're doing, is safety. And really, in a compressed amount of time, we teach these folks how to fight fire safely, how to pay attention and what to look for as the indicators of changing conditions on the fire line in the fire environment. Weather is probably one of the most dynamic challenges in the fire environment. And so we do spend a reasonable amount of time on fire weather, fire behavior, and safety practices that are commensurate with the tactics we teach them in actually suppressing the fire.
Does an example come to mind? Something that, look, you, I don't expect you to know this, but you need to know this. So listen, what's an example?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things, and especially with the weather patterns we're seeing in the last couple of weeks, we're seeing lightning activity. And one of the things that's very dangerous with lightning activity is when a thunder cell comes into the fire area, you've got indrafts and outdrafts. And that thunder cell itself is really creating its own kind of micro weather. And so you can be working on a fire and have active lightning in the area. And as that thunder cell moves over, you know really to expect the unexpected. You know you're going to have increased winds. So we teach them what thunder cells look like, how they develop, and if nothing else, to be able to expect the unexpected when those are in the environment.
I understand you have a demonstration where you soak a fire suit in repellent and strike a match.
Well, that was something that was kind of interesting, and again, we're taking folks that come from different walks of life and different experience sets, and we noticed that when these folks are deployed, perhaps overseas or in a jungle environment, they will actually use bug repellent not only on their skin, but they'll cover their uniforms in it too, to ensure they have a good saturation of to keep out critters. We did notice they were doing that on a fire last year. And the problem with that is insect repellent's flammable. And so to demonstrate the point, we actually took a set of firefighter clothing that's made out of Nomex, which is, you know, fire-resistant material. We did saturate it in insect repellent and lit on fire as it burst into flames. We wanted to demonstrate that this isn't the environment to be saturating your clothes in insect repellent.
Okay, good examples of a lot to learn. And then finally, on the flip side, Aaron, what is the big advantage of the National Guard being called in here?
Well, I think the big advantage of the Guard is they're used to coming together, and even though it might not be wildland fire specific, they're used to going to places of chaos, and they're used to going into situations that have significant safety considerations. They're a fantastic group to work with. They're happy to help the local communities in Washington, and again, they're plentiful.
Governor Jay Inslee calling on the National Guard to help fight wildfires in central and eastern Washington. And we've been talking with Aaron Schmidt, Fire Operations Chief of the Department of Natural Resources, helping to get these folks up to speed. Aaron, thanks a lot for this.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Same to you. So, as we said, Governor Inslee declaring the state of emergency gives Washington State some help in fighting fires. But are we doing the right thing when we fight wildfires? My next guest is an environmental journalist. He just wrote a piece in Harper's Magazine titled Combustion Engines that takes a look at the bigger picture here. Richard Manning, thanks for joining us on KUOW.
Well, thanks for having me.
What about the way we approach and fight wildfires? What are we getting wrong?
Well, we're focusing all the attention on the immediate situation. In other words, we're saying we can handle fires, we can put them out, we can send in the National Guard and helicopters and deal with it. When in fact, what we should be doing is reacting well in advance of the fires. And what we should have done 30 years ago is do something about global warming. Mm-hmm. Global warming is really what's causing these fires today, and they're making them unmanageable. We cannot deal with them. And then more specifically, now what we should be doing is stopping people from building houses in the woods. It's about that simple. We spend something like $6 billion a year in this country putting wildfires out, and 95% of that money is spent on 15% of the land where houses are built. In other words, we're spending our money and risking the lives of National Guards people like you just talked to protect houses.
How would we prevent people from building houses in the woods? How would you define the woods?
Well, it's well defined actually in fire science. They have an unmanageable name for it called the WUI, which means the wildland urban interface. That just means houses in the woods. But it's all mapped out in every state in the West, and it's very clear where it is. And every county knows where it is. What they won't do is do the zoning required to prevent people from building in those areas. And with the wildfires becoming much, much more intense, orders of magnitude more intense, we can no longer hold on to these areas just as we can no longer hold on to hurricane-prone areas like Houston. And so we're going to have to back off. And that's how we do it.
So if it's a matter of costs and benefits, let's talk about the other side of the ledger. I mean, do you understand, Richard, what people get out of the questionable decision of living in wild and wildish wooded areas?
Sure, I do. And they could do so wisely, though. And one of the things to do is understand not all of that area has to be off limits, but some of it does. And if you do build there, you have to do things like plan exit routes so you can get out of there. Most people are really killed trying to escape a fire. And then build a house in a way that's fireproof. So you use a steel roof instead of a cedar shake roof, for instance. All of those things can be mandated in zoning, and in the end would do things like prevent the loss of firefighters' lives.
Why do we build cedar shake roofs in the woods instead of metal roofs?
Well, people got away with it for a long time, 30 years, and so the habits die hard. And in pre-global warming times, you could get away with that kind of stupid decision or get away with it for about 20 years. But now we no longer can talk in those terms because the wildfires are so prevalent that you can't get away with stupidity any longer.
Do you want people who are already on their land to be, I don't know, forced out, bought out by the government and moved off their land?
Or the alternative could be burned out, and that's happening a lot more than we'd like to admit. And so that sort of thing is happening by default these days simply because we're unable to manage the fires. But no, more likely what we would do is take a look at people who have already built in those places and say, no, you may need to make these changes. And we've done that in a lot of places in the West. And sometimes the changes amount to maybe $5,000, which is what somebody would spend on their kitchen countertops these days. Why not do that to prevent your house from burning down?
And are you advocating for less firefighting, less fire suppression?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I don't have to advocate for it. We have done a lot less in a lot of places in the West. We've had a wilderness policy in place now for 30, 40 years in wilderness areas of allowing fires to resume their natural role on the landscape. And in those areas, fires have gotten much smaller. We spend almost no money on them, and they have achieved enormous ecological advantage by restoring those landscapes. We need to do things that look like that in the interface where the houses are.
By the way, you write about how houses can become what you call ladder fuel for other houses that you would think are in safe places.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting phenomenon, and it first emerged in a lot of the California fires. And I know fire scientists with whole collections of photographs showing a charred remains of a house and standing next to it green trees, actual live trees, which means the fire would burn the house down, but if not hot enough to kill the trees. So those fires spread house to house, not tree to tree. And it's pretty unfair to call them a forest fire anymore. Those are subdivision fires.
So what is the most likely change you see us making in the near future? I mean, obviously there's going to be resistance to, being told where you can't live, also being told what you've got to do with your property.
Yeah, it really won't matter if there's resistance. A lot of houses are going to burn down anyhow. It doesn't matter what we say about it. It is beyond our control at this point. And that's the change that has occurred in firefighter culture. If you talk to wildland firefighters, they're really pretty humble guys these days, guys and women now. And they'll tell you that, no, we really don't put these fires out anymore. The weather puts them out. And that change in culture needs to happen across the board. We understand it. But I hesitate to talk about that in some ways because that implies that this is the new normal. This is what we have to adjust to. When in fact, I think it's going to get a whole lot worse. And so what we prescribe today as sensible steps will no longer be sensible steps 10 years from now, when it becomes even more unmanageable and even more catastrophic.
When you describe wild managers, land managers, changing their culture and beginning to accept that, no, it's weather that's going to put this thing out, are you saying that people who might be expecting to have someone protect their land and their property, they might be surprised to find out how much standing down there actually is?
Yeah, they really are, and someone will be angry about it. But the firefighters got that way, not by inclination. They're inclined to put a fire out, but reluctantly. And the ones I've talked to will invariably give me a story about stuffing a body bag with a teenager and saying, you know, we tried to put this one out, and one firefighter I talked to talked to something like 13 of his friends had died in fires. They got humbled by being chastised by nature, and the rest of us need to get that way as well.
So finally, Richard Manning, what do you want us to take away from your latest piece in Harper's Magazine, Combustion Engine? What's the lesson?
Well, the lesson, I think, is the instructive nature of fire for all of us now, not just those of us who live under fire. And everybody I talk to about fire now and over the course of 30 years talk in terms of, well, this is what I want. This is the way I want the landscape to be. And what we need to understand is the landscape will never be the way we want to for the rest of our lives. That's what global warming means. We are in the midst of global warming. It is incredibly catastrophic. And we are going to deal with that catastrophe from here on in. Our lives will never be the same. It doesn't matter who we are.
Richard Manning, environment journalist, author of 8 books, and his latest article on how the West manages wildfires is the cover story of this month's Harper Magazine. Richard, great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.